a market, say like Ireland, it definitely forces you to focus, to put constraints on you. The capital constrains you. I would struggle if people threw hundreds of millions at me.
You know, I almost think of it more as like, why is the short guy good at shooting from the outside? And I would say, because he kind of has to be.
This is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health.
Some people are just born for business. While others were out playing ball and dreaming about being firemen, Jim Joyce, serial entrepreneur, was building business after business. Today, he is CEO of HealthBeacon, his second healthcare startup, headquartered in Dublin, Ireland.
This is Tectonics. I'm David Chawitz.
And I'm Lisa Soonan. And today's episode is brought to you by HealthXL, a global enterprise that empowers leading organizations and innovators to solve major healthcare problems through digital health collaboration. So I find that it's speaking to entrepreneurs from other countries is particularly interesting, and I enjoy greatly those who are born entrepreneurs. You know,
do you think that there are born, is an entrepreneur, Lisa, do you think an entrepreneur is born or made? It's a kind of a relevant question out here in the Valley.
I think they're born. I think people either have that risk, you know, affinity, that, you know, live fast, die young kind of thing, or they don't.
Because Chris Sacco was saying that at some conference the other day. He was saying that everybody is sort of hiring themselves like an entrepreneur. And he's like, get over it. Most of you aren't founders. You're not like crazy enough and inspired enough to be a founder and don't think you are. And that's okay. Maybe you were born to be employee number three and that's okay.
Yeah, no, I think that's, I really do think that's right. And I think I see it particularly in companies that are growing to be, you know, they're growing larger, but they still, they need a new CEO and they bring in somebody from a big corporation, but it's still really an entrepreneurial endeavor and they have a very hard time coming across and making that grade, you know?
That's interesting. So you think that the problem is that people bring in an adult CEO too early versus too late? Because other folks wonder that you have all these people who have this like excitement and hope to kind of start doing the impossible. But then the question is when you can sort of kind of convert it to a real business.
Well, if you think about the iconic businesses that have become absolutely great, they're all, you know, still run by their founders, or they were for a very long time.
Right, right, between Google and Amazon, Oracle.
Apple, you know, it's really an interesting thing. Anyways, we'll get to follow up on this theme today a bit. His Jim Joyce is our guest. He started with a newspaper business, expanded into house painting, made his way to pharma, which is an obvious transition, and then digital health. He started two companies in digital health, the latest of which is HealthBeacon, a company with products that help patients who use self-injectable medications at home manage medical adherence, manage medical waste, and the like. So, Jim, welcome to the show today.
Great to be with you guys.
We're delighted to have you. And I'm going to start with a little history for those listening. So your Irish namesake, James Joyce. Were you named after James Joyce, Jim?
Well, yeah, distant horse thieves is what people tell me. But
So James Joyce once said, "A man of genius makes no mistakes. His errors are volitional and are the portraits of discovery." What do you think about that? Was that, have your mistakes been portals of discovery?
Absolutely.
What's your biggest one? Tell us about your biggest mistake and how you learned from that.
Other than being on our podcast.
It's a big list. I think one of the biggest ones, just jumping into the business side of it was, I remember coming to Ireland and setting up my first company after working in the industry at some level. And I decided that, you know, my first company had to go out with a huge splash. And so I rented the first floor of a top hotel and got, you know, ministers and, you know, healthcare professionals to sit around me. And I launched a company and I probably realized.
Did you have models? They do models at JP Morgan.
I guess the Irish version is ministers, right?
Yeah. It was one of those things where I felt the need to do it. And, you know, and I probably spent years trying to actually build a business model after that. And I don't regret it because the PR kind of, you know, blasted me into the scene. But, you know, this one, I definitely, try to crack the business first before you go out with lots of PR. I guess that's probably the biggest one.
And I guess, you know, I hear so much in the Valley these days about the value of failure. Failure is a noble badge of honor. Is that true? Is failure good for entrepreneurs or bad for entrepreneurs?
Yeah, I think it depends on the type of failure. It's one of those things. You know, you put the question out when you were talking with David about, you know, are you born an entrepreneur? I think that, you know, some failure, you know, obviously can be so devastating, and, you know, can really just, you know, get inside the psyche of people. And, you know, when other failures are so illuminating, you know, when I think about, you know, the failures for me of, you know, of, you know, that moment when you weren't going to make payroll, or, you know, you get the news that the contract you were working on for 2 years just went to someone else. You know, those are incredibly illuminating about how you respond to it. And, you know, so it definitely makes the entrepreneurs, you definitely need them. But you also, you know, frankly, have to survive them. You know, you just have to.
I mean, one of the things that, for example, Bezos always talks about is that constraints and limitations is what fosters creativity. On the other hand, you can't run a company if you're broke. So it seems to be sort of a fine line between having constraints and challenges, which are sort of inevitable, but still having enough capital to function.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. When I think about one of the things of, say, starting, you know, we were just in San Francisco a few weeks ago and looking at some of the companies and how exciting they were and, you know, and all the opportunities there. And frankly, there's probably just less opportunities in a market, say, like Ireland. And it definitely forces you to focus, you know, to go, you know, to put constraints on you. The capital constrains you, you know, the availability of capital. I think I would struggle if people threw hundreds of millions at me. I might like it.
You get over it though.
Yeah, right.
Over
it. Treasure bath.
But I mean, people, so, you know, by that reasoning, I mean, one of the things that, so the positive take I've heard is, so right lately in the Valley, as you know, people are talking about it, you know, is there a bubble, the book by Dan Lyons, you know, it's, you know, the bubble. And that, you know, what people are saying is there was so much easy money for so long that essentially, like you're describing, companies kind of got lazy. They took the money because it was available, but they didn't necessarily deploy it wisely. And they sort of accrued these excessive valuations. So now there sort of some reality sets in, there's sort of a real thought that maybe there'll actually be some kind of flight to quality, and that being careful with your money, actually having revenue, is going to become increasingly important. Do you think it's hard to keep that focus and to sort of to be prudent when there's so much money floating around?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I mean, you know, my model, you know, how I go about business building is, you know, is I force those constraints. You know, when I think about it, and I think when you're in healthcare specifically. At the end of the day, you know, someone, the insurer, the payer, the government, the patient, someone needs to pick up the bill for it. And so you really have to think about, you know, if you can do something with a team of three engineers or, you know, a certain number of medical professionals or a certain platform, then you really almost have an obligation to try to do that. Because at the end of the day, you know, if the medications or the products or the technology becomes too expensive, it won't be accessible.
You know, you said a minute ago, Jim, that that you can't easily build a business in Ireland, or I think that's what I heard you say. You know, I know in the U.S., you know, the conventional wisdom is that you can't build a company outside the U.S. if you haven't been able to tackle the U.S. Do you think digital health companies need to start with a global perspective? Do you need to start with a global perspective, or can you build a business of size in your home continent, wherever that might be?
Yeah, no, I mean, I suppose that, you know, when I was talking before, I think you can build businesses, you know, and you know, and I've obviously done that in Ireland, and and they'll just be different type of businesses, especially in their early years. And, you know, I think there's this whole scale question. I think when you're in a market like Ireland, you know, one of the benefits is that you immediately have to think about exporting that product. Like if you want to, you know, get any level of funding to, you know, to grow the company, you know, they won't fund, in most cases, they won't fund companies that just focus at the indigenous market. So you have to build something that actually works in Ireland because you got to test it, but it also has to work in your next biggest market. And so,
is that a challenge? Because the constraints and the incentives, particularly between, you know, a large market like the U.S., seems so different than the rest of the world, as one or two people have observed. So, you know, I would imagine that if you're what works and where you're able to sort of identify inefficiencies and provide solutions for systems with, let's say, Ireland's incentives, is that going to really transplant to a chaotic system like the U.S.?
I mean, for God's sakes, you guys use S's instead of Z's when you write English.
Exactly. Yeah.
Can you give us an example?
Yeah, no, I think I can. I mean, there's a common themes, I think, when you look at healthcare systems, and, you know, and I always like to think about it from, you know, my background was in the pharmaceutical industry. And if you look how, you know, clinical trials are done, you know, products are licensed, and they eventually are distributed into the marketplace, you know, usually through a doctor that prescribes it for their kind of captive population of patients. You know, that same system is, you know, is the same in Ireland, the UK, Australia, you know, and the US. And so you have this kind of underlying system. So I think you definitely want to think about, you know, in the case of, you know, the companies we're building is if we can piggyback that kind of core way that, you know, medicines are licensed and think about the technology or products that we bring to market, and we try to keep that as the theme, then you actually, I think you can, in some cases, might be able to come out with a more focused product. You know, we don't have to, you know, in our first instances, you know, we have to think in a simple way. You know, we get very good access to all the senior people within the healthcare system. The system's less complex, you know, so our product becomes less complex. And then, but you got to keep an eye on the big market, you know. So I think in our example, you know, we are trying to use the pharmaceutical industry as a launch pad, you know, into other markets, including the U.S.
So what's the specific example of a product that you developed in Ireland? We've been successful and then have deployed or have seen deployed more broadly. Could you just sort of help make this more concrete for us and our listeners?
Sure. I mean, there's obviously the company that I co-founded right now, the Health Beacon Project, where you know, we've developed a smart sharps container that, you know, for all patients that go on self-injectable medications, which is a massive market, they need a safe way to dispose of their medications. And so that's a common theme anywhere. And you have a case where the pharmaceutical industry is willing to step in and kind of go beyond the pill, beyond the injectable, you know, device, and actually provide patient supports. So, you know, so our product, you know, is a medical adherence tool, you know, that can work in an Irish home or could work in a US home. And we find that the pharmaceutical industry and, you know, their partners are willing to provide that support, you know, in those different markets. You know, so I guess, you know, that's an example. I could think of other ones that I've been involved in, you know, the use of, you know, video messaging and video educational tools. You know, again, very common themes, you know, throughout there. We developed a product called HealthSnap that, you know, in the past that again has very commonality, you know, and can be used in any market.
So I know you spent some time, you know, traversing the great frontier of Cleveland when you were building your company.
Sure.
Using the Cleveland Clinic as a partner, working with them as a partner to help think about what you do. Do you have to overcome some assumption that it's different, better, worse, the accent, the language, the anything? I mean, obviously we all speak English, but it is different.
Yep.
You know, what is the biggest learning from that, or what was the biggest challenge in getting the Cleveland Clinic excited? Because they're a tough customer.
Yeah. We sometimes say that the Irish and the Americans are divided by a common language. You know, that's kind of I think looking at that. You know, in this case, it's kind of about partnerships and relationships. You know, I think one of the things that, you know, the Irish market's a very human market, if that makes any sense, meaning the culturally, you know, they're very good at forming relationships and, you know, using and leveraging those relationships. So really the Cleveland Clinic project came about as a result of, you know, forming really strong relationships with some people inside the innovations group there. And, you know, they got excited about, you know, our vision for the company, our vision for the product. You know, we were working with, you know, the folks at Health Excel to kind of introduce that project in. And, you know, and you just saw people, you know how it is, it's just like yourselves, you know, you just can't help but get excited about an entrepreneur, you know, doing something different. We had a real physical product, you know, that, you know, and I think that's in terms of this company, the Health Beacon, we got a beautiful looking product, you know, that fits into a patient home, and it just opens up curiosity. People want to touch it and work with it and try it out. So I think getting exploration with them, we found it took a while. It definitely took longer than if that project was in an Irish.
And this was facilitated by HealthXL, because you sort of wonder how can aspiring companies that have seemingly relevant products connect with large healthcare organizations that on the one hand seem to be innovation friendly, but are notoriously hard to sell into. What was the, it seems in this case, there was a catalyst. What did they do?
Yeah, so they had a program where you basically submitted interesting projects and collaboration. So we submitted a project in around medical adherence and self-injectable medications, and then we were able to coalesce a few partners that thought it was interesting. They helped us kind of scope the project. So we were real cognizant that Cleveland Clinic is a big system. And we tried to keep the project real small and interesting, in its initial phase. So they helped us kind of scope that, stayed with it, provided some resources around that, and kind of guided us through. I mean, it was as much a challenge as anyone, because our business is actually, it's going quite well, in the European setting. So we had to really think about, do we want to go off and head to Cleveland to explore it?
yeah. Someone not consider that a promotion.
Cleveland gets a bad rap. You know, it's where Rockefeller started.
Oh, really?
That's true.
I did not. Also, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is there. So
yeah, I love Cleveland. I love Cleveland. The flats, the whole place.
Ever since the river stopped burning, it's been a much better place. But you grew up in Boston, right? I mean, I know you've got this funny half Boston, half Irish accent. So, like, how does an Irish guy from Boston accidentally end up moving back to Ireland? How does that work out? I thought it always went the other way.
Yeah.
Do you fit in either place?
Yeah, no, I think with the accent, they probably won't accept me in either place right now. They won't accept me in Dublin, or they won't accept me in Boston. Yeah, no, it's one of those funny things. I mean, you talked about your quote of discovery and everything. For me, I remember when it was fashionable to do an MBA. Probably dating myself because that has been probably a little while. the idea, I was looking at MBA programs, and here I was in Boston. It was a great, I had been working in the investment industry actually. And I said, wow, wouldn't that be fantastic?
Those Boston-based MBAs are so overrated though,
Clearly Lisa has chosen not to burden herself with one.
Yeah. But I was thinking to myself, I said, there's 50,000, at the time there was 50,000, MBA graduates coming out of these, different programs. And I said, imagine if I came out with an MBA, from Ireland, and, someone had kind of put the idea in my head. So I went out and explored it, and I ended up going to University College of Dublin, where my now wife was an Italian actually studying at the University of Venice, from the University of Venice in Dublin. And, we met, we did the MBA.
Was she looking for worse food or something? Was that the problem?
Actually, she wasn't looking for Irish guys because she found an American one. But we ended up getting recruited back into the U.S. pharmaceutical industry of all places. So it was one of those, I was probably open to it because I've, got Irish roots. The idea of it, my French wasn't so good. So if I wanted to go to Europe, that would have been tricky. I ended up there. And I think ultimately, we are, being married to an Italian, being from Boston, we kind of found this windy island in the middle of the two places, that kind of compromise. So no one has to live, with the other's relatives,
Well, I know we're in the middle of the NBA playoffs, as it happens, as we record this show. And I know you and your sons are big basketball fans, fans of the Celtics. Is it being an entrepreneur like running a sports team? Is it about that orchestration of the folks with the perfect positions, or is it a different endeavor altogether?
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, I like sports analogies as much as the next person. And there's so many aspects of those sports teams that you kind of bring, you can bring into, properly running a company or having it. But I think what's different about, some of these companies, or like the ones you've interviewed on this podcast, is you want the sports team to help you, kind of get the ball into the hoop, but in this fantastic way,
the ring, as Cruz would say.
I almost think of it more as like, why is the short guy good at shooting from the outside? And I would say, because he kind of has to be. But you need a big vision. And you need this long term. You talked about founders. Founders that start companies, ultimately building these iconic companies. And I think if you're in the healthcare space and you're thinking about, how do you solve, problems for chronic patients, that need to be, you know, treated or maintained on medications in the home. You have to have this kind of much bigger picture, and you really have to kind of, reverse things, really turn the tables. I'm not sure the analogy always holds true. You have a fairly constrained system inside, sports but as an entrepreneur, I think the big ones, if you look at like these big exciting companies that are out there,
what companies inspire you?
Yeah, I mean, I think the ones that kind of inspire me are these, like the Amazon, the Amazons of the world, or even the ones that you've had on this podcast, like the fellow, Sean Duffy from Omada Health, or the Jeff Bezos example that you guys reference is he's playing to his own rules. He goes to reinvent, selling books, then he reinvents distribution, and then he reinvents, how we all put our applications on the internet, and builds this massive, powerful business.
Right. So I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I'm tremendously inspired by Bezos in particular and by the Amazon story. But if you talk about Amazon to a typical, to somebody who's, just like reading the papers, they'll say, oh yeah, Amazon, I read about them in a New York Times magazine. They treat their employees like ass. Do you worry about that? I mean, do you think that's part and parcel of the entrepreneur experience? Do you think that's what Dan Lyons argues in his current book, that there's a sort of this
waterboarding is essential to success.
Well, though apparently it's not completely true that there are Amazon has employees crying over. I mean, actually, I think that a lot of the parts of that of the sort of this New York Times magazine story weren't true. Yeah. But on the other hand, there really is a sense of it being, there's a certain tough, underappreciated, beyond the romance of all the entrepreneurship and changing the world.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a certain brutality to the culture as well. Is that something that you've had exposure to?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, you definitely see it. I mean, I think, entrepreneurs in some ways, they're vicious in a positive way, in the sense that they will do anything to build that company and make it successful.
Vicious in a positive way as like a definition of entrepreneur. That's really interesting. I like to kind of I don't know if it's Joycean, but it's
it's
visual.
It's just like if someone, Stephen King wanting to write books and you wonder, they'll do anything to get that book written and they will sacrifice a lot. And I think you have to be that way. I think what's different in healthcare, or I'd like to believe it's different in healthcare, is it's such a human industry, and you have to make sure that you create a culture that ultimately can hopefully deliver better healthcare. And I think there's other industries where, the margin or the finance, the way it operates and the way it looks at it, it might have a different dynamic. You have cold engineering cultures or highly efficient cultures like Amazon, where it's distribution led, and you need those aspects in healthcare. But you also need to have this at the end of the day, a patient is going to be receiving what you have to provide them. And if you have employees that aren't embodying that we care about that, I'm not sure you're going to be able to build a very good healthcare company, whether it's a digital healthcare company or a services company.
So interesting.
So, Jim, there's this whole trend, and it's continues to grow, I think, that in order to get a digital health company off the ground, check box one is join an accelerator. is that a good thing for helping build your corporate strategy and culture, a bad thing? Does it depend? What do you, how do you view that movement?
Yeah, I struggle with that one. I think for me, I'm not a first time entrepreneur. So I think I probably had to learn the hard way. In some ways, I wish, there were all these accelerators when I was starting my first company. I mean, there was a lot of things that I definitely learned the hard way. So I think they're phenomenal. They can be, these phenomenal resources help entrepreneurs avoid simple mistakes, or mistakes that have been. So I think even like the fact that all these are exist and they develop podcasts and you can read articles. I think the whole entrepreneurism has benefited from all these accelerators. For me personally, I like to go out, I like to build, I like to own my culture and own the brand and own what I'm doing. So sometimes I find them a little bit in conflict with what I'm doing. And
how so? Could you help us understand that?
I think a physical, like when I take a look at, say, Health Beacon, and I looked at everything from the physical space you know, what we spend time on, you know, what we think is important. You know, I think that, you know, me getting trained on how to pitch the next investor is it's just less valuable to me today. Or if I need that kind of coaching, I'll go seek it out. You know, me being set up on a routine or a schedule or a cadence, you know, that the accelerator is creating, I think might have been tremendously beneficial when I was first starting my first companies. But as a second or third company, you know, I have to create that own cadence myself, and I have to create those own dynamics. And ultimately, I want people, when they walk into my company, to be walking into our company, and I want them to help build that vision, the physical office space, you know, the, you know, what's on the walls, you know, how you organize, you know, who greets you at the door. You know, I want them to be health beaconites.
Well, so this is so interesting. Are you sort of suggesting that a potential concern with this, the newfound interest and the obviously, you know, sort of expression of passion for entrepreneurship and all of these accelerators is a tendency to sort of see it as a little bit of a, not quite carbon copies, but sort of like a startup factory, and this is sort of what a startup looks like, and everyone's trying to, you know, out here maybe, you know, do the hipster dress and act a certain way, dress a certain way, do a certain thing, and it's ironically
play ping pong.
but the idea is that, you know, it almost makes a mockery of some of the ideas of what entrepreneurship is supposed to be about, where you do things in an individual and a creative way. And that now it sort of seems like there's people are expressing their individuality and creativity in a very standardized, expected fashion. And it sounds like what you're saying is the need to, you know, it's nice to have some resources from these accelerators, but also to have the independence to not to have to follow those models.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's what I'm saying. When I think about, you know, kind of lateral thinkers, you know, people that can connect different dots and see different things, you know, I think if you I might be unique. Like I remember when I was setting up one of my first.
Oh, I'm sure you are.
Yeah, an Irish guy named Jim Joyce. That's pretty unique.
When I was setting up my first company, and I was like, oh, this is great. I can choose where my office is. And then I said, well, I can also, because I don't have a rush, I could choose how I commute to work every day. And I would commute to work five different ways, you know, during the course of a week, you know, during the 5 days. And my wife thought that was absolutely mad. And I just didn't like the constraints. You know, I had actually worked in big companies for years, and I just found that, you know, if I wanted to take the bus or bike or walk or, you know, despite the fact that the rain sometimes in Ireland stops that, I could do it. And I think the other big thing is, you know, really depends on the quality of these accelerators. Like, you know, they can do amazing things. Like, you know, they can put all these people in the room that you would take months and months to try to access. So that's phenomenal. But, you know, then a lot of times, you know, your most precious asset as an entrepreneur, which is hard to realize, is sometimes not money. It's time, you know, it's in focus. And right. They take you off that focus of that mission, you know, even for an hour or 2 hours. You know, who knows, you know, what you could have done. Maybe it was nothing, but maybe it was that, you know, that time to kind of, you know, edge your product to that next level, you know.
So you build a great company. I know your prior company, Point of Care, was quite successful. You build a company, it's imbued with your culture. You've got your favorite folks hanging around. They're kicking it, killing, you know, just knocking it out of the park. And then you sell it. You sell it to, in this case, Unifar Group. Is that like giving away your baby? Is that hard? Or coming from a huge family like you do, is it nice to give away a baby, get more food?
I think all of the above. Yeah, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, ultimately I think about a company like a child, in the sense that, you know, at first the company, you know,
there's a lot of crying and a lot of dirty diapers.
Can't walk, it can't find its way. Then eventually you teach it to kind of clean itself or get to the store or, you know, go to school or get its homework done. And maybe it gets an interview, you know, for a small job when it's 18, you know, and eventually the company has to kind of leave the nest of the parent, you know. I think it's not easy for the parent, you know, when the child leaves home. But I think for me, the biggest thing for that company in this case, for it to be successful, it needed to partner with a really big, you know, for it to kind of reach its full potential, it needed to partner, you know, with a much bigger.
So you're trying to marry it off well, is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, exactly. An arranged marriage.
The dowry.
So I
think, three goats and some stock options. But
I consider this part of my counseling session over that right now, though.
Well, Jim, we're getting to the end of our time here. It's been so much fun to talk to you.
And, a real pleasure.
What's your one pithy piece of advice for the entrepreneurs out there thinking about the global marketplace?
Yeah, I think, the big piece of advice when I think about it is, you know, there's been a lot of talk about, you know, where we are in terms of developing technology. And, you know, when we're in the healthcare technology space, it's going to be about partnership and building, you know, really solid, you know, business models, you know, that are sustainable. I think that's, I'm not sure if that's pithy, but that's my advice.
And it's been great to talk to you today. Thank you so much for your time and for being here.
Great. Thank you. Really enjoyed the show, everyone. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Take care, Jim. Bye-bye. Today's guest, Jim Joyce, was speaking to us today from the land of his namesake, Dublin, Ireland.
He's a really interesting guy. I really like talking with him.
Yeah. You know, those Irish guys are so creative and fun to work with. The culture really just like to make...
You've been over there a few
positive,
times, haven't you?
You know, yeah, I have. And working over there is a blast because they really don't have a line between what's social and what's work in the way that we do, you know?
Yeah.
And it makes for a tremendous collaboration and partnership, I think.
Yeah, I think it's from all the time I spent in Boston, I'm just an Ireland wannabe, I guess.
Yeah, well, it's pretty great over there. And you do have a lot of fun, I must admit.
You can follow Lisa Soonan at Venture Valkyrie, as well as on the Timmerman Report.
And you can follow David Shewitz's writing at Forbes.
We are grateful to HealthXL for sponsoring this episode of Tectonics. HealthXL is a global enterprise that empowers leading organizations and innovators to solve major healthcare problems through digital health collaborations.
This episode of Tectonics is produced by Connected Social Media and recorded in Tectonics Studio A, Hillsborough, California.